This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary meeting May 5th, 1987 at 3 p.m. in Hearing Room 343. We'll have a public hearing on House Bills 2179 and 2437 and Senate Bill 726, a work session on Senate Bill 441, 358, and 296, and a public hearing also on House Bills 2309 and 3071.
Let's go to Senate Bill 726.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Let's have Ed Lewis and Peter Jarvis both up here. 726. Come on up.
Senator Frye, Gary Conklin intended to join us, but he's down in the Senate Labor Committee, so he'll...
Well, did you want to wait then?
No, go ahead. I think we can go ahead and he'll...
He would defer to you fellows anyway, I know that.
He said that he was going to be here shortly. My name is Ed Lewis, and I'm an Associate General Counsel of Tektronix, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 726. I'm also a member of the Corporate Counsel Committee of the Oregon's Corporate Counsel Committee of the Corporate and Business Section of the Oregon State Bar, and that committee also supports this bill. I furnished the committee on Friday with a memorandum that describes Tech's support of this bill, and I'm not going to go over that and rehash that again, but I would like to comment on a few of the highlights and some other items. The basic purpose of the bill is to amend the definition of representative or client with respect to the attorney-client privilege to broaden it from the existing control group test. The existing attorney-client privilege statute in Oregon adopts the control group test, which limits the privilege to communications between an attorney and a client, where the client is a corporation or other organization, to the very top level of management of the corporation, i.e. the officers and directors of the corporation, and potentially in a situation where a company like Tech would be involved, where it's a large company, potentially the control group would include the absolute top level of management, those individuals who are not also officers. We believe that the control group test that was adopted by the legislature in 81, is not an appropriate test in that it's too restrictive. This was also the determination of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1981 in the case of Upjohn versus United States, where the court held that information furnished by middle and lower level managers to a corporate attorney who was in the process of conducting an investigation on behalf of the corporation should be privileged under the federal evidence law, and they reversed the decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to the contrary. I'm not sure it was the Ninth Circuit. I'm not sure what circuit it was, but court did reverse the circuit court decision. And in that decision, the court rejected the control group test because it did not permit the full and frank exchange of information necessary for an attorney to advise the corporation. The court declined to adopt a specific standard but did throw out the control group test. We believe that the control group test leaves a big void because the privileges, as we believe it exists, does not extend to communications between middle and lower level managers and their attorneys. It also would not extend to a communication between a corporate employee and the attorney, where the employee is a non-manager and is merely furnishing information that the attorney is going to use in turn to furnish advice to the corporation. In Tech's case, we have approximately 9,600 employees in the state of Oregon. But we only have 28 executive officers and directors that would clearly be covered by the privilege. And if you say that, well, the privilege under the control group test is also going to extend to the first level of top management who are not also officers, you would add another 38 people, so approximately 70 people would come within the control group test. Now, it depends a little bit on how you size that test, but I think that's a fair reading of the test, and that would mean only 70 people within tech could have communications with either inside or outside counsel that would be privileged. The bill is intended to change that, to amend the definition of representative client, so that confidential communications between an attorney and an employee of a corporation or other organization, where either the employee provides information to the attorney in connection with the attorney providing advice for the corporation, or the employee who, as a part of his or her relationship with the corporation, seeks advice. In both those situations, the privilege would apply and the communication would be considered confidential. As you know, the purpose of the privilege is to facilitate the free flow of information between the attorney and the client. Privilege recognizes that sound legal advice serves public ends, and that such advice or advocacy depends upon the attorney being fully informed by the client. Regretfully, in our complex world, all levels of management from time to time have a continuing need for legal advice. They have need for legal advice in the areas of contract, government regulation, land use law, employment, and a host of other legal issues. And they expect that those communications with their attorneys would be confidential, and they would not expect that the attorney could be called as a witness and required to testify as to the nature of that communication. But under current Oregon law, that could very well occur unless the person having the communication happens to be an officer, a director, or an absolute top level of management. We believe that the control group test can discourage employees from seeking advice. Clearly, if their attorney gets called and the attorney is required to testify as to the nature of the communication, diminish the quality of the information received and in turn the quality of the advice being given, and could potentially have a chilling effect on the furnishing of information. For if the attorney can't get good information, he or she cannot give good advice. This is especially important in the sorts of things that I do because a lot of my practice involves preventive law, trying to help the corporation make sure that it's doing things correctly. And I rely heavily on getting information from our people regarding the facts of particular matters. And it's also important that people feel comfortable in calling and asking for legal advice. And if their communications are subject to discovery, then that certainly can impact that relationship. To give you a couple of examples of kinds of things that can come up in the preventive law area, one would be a situation where a human resources person comes to the corporate attorney and asks for advice on a situation where one of the employees in the group that the human resource person works for has been involved in sexual harassment involving another employee. The HR person wants advice on the risks to the company with regard to this particular matter, would want to review the various types of discipline that could be followed, and would want to know what would be the potential ramification to the company. The attorney would advise the HR person on such things as whether or not the company would be exposed to a wrongful termination claim by the attorney if termination were determined to be the appropriate discipline, whether or not the terminated employee could have a claim for defamation, would also advise the HR person on whether or not the employee who was subject to the sexual harassment could have a claim against the company if the company didn't take appropriate action with regard to the employee that was involved in this conduct. Under current Oregon law, in most cases, those communications would not be privileged. The attorney and the HR person could be required to testify in the event there was later litigation as to the contents of those communications, not only what the HR person asked about, but also what the attorney advised as far as the potential risk to the company. Another potential example would be a situation where a startup company is getting its technology in place, and an engineer consults an outside attorney, because in this case it's doubtful that the small startup company is going to have an inside attorney, but consults the attorney on the issues of protecting the proprietary information, the technology of the corporation. The engineer requests advice on how to protect the information. He provides information to the attorney, and the attorney in turn provides advice on how that information can be protected. Subsequently, the startup company gets into a dispute with a competitor. The competitor claims that the information is really technology that belongs to the competitor. Litigation ensues. Again, in that situation, based on the current state of the law, both the engineer and the attorney could be required to testify concerning the contents of those communications, both what the engineer asked about and what the attorney advised.
Well, let me ask you this hypothetical. Going back to your sexual harassment, the hypothetical there, suppose the HR supervisor asked for this legal advice, and you gave advice to this person, and the person just decided to ignore it and let the situation go on.
Uh-huh.
And the employee then brings an action where certainly state of mind would be an element in the case. Now, are you saying that this bill then would preclude any evidence that this HR person purposely disregarded advice on how to avoid the situation? Because if you couldn't get at the fact that there was a communication directed to the HR person saying, do this or don't do that, it would remove the chance of proving, I suppose, that the person acted with callous disregard of the legal consequences.
Well, it wouldn't change the underlying facts and whether or not sexual harassment did occur and whether it rise to the level of protected activity that should have been dealt with. But the fact that the person did communicate with an attorney, I think that would be admissible. But as far as the advice that the attorney gave, that would not be admissible.
Well, all right, let's take this. Suppose the suppose there's a complaint made by a female employee of sexual harassment and to the HR supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
And the supervisor makes some investigation and finds out that there indeed has been something that seems to fit that type of conduct, then goes to the corporate lawyer, relates the facts, and gets advice on what to do.
Yes.
Under this bill, none of the HR person's own investigation or knowledge could be developed, because...
No. That's not correct.
Well, you help me on that thing.
All right. The only thing that could be protected would be the communication that the HR representative had with the attorney. The fact that the HR representative conducted an investigation would be fully discoverable. And that gets to this issue that's been raised from time to time regarding this bill about whether or not the bill goes further than just protecting the communication and somehow protects the underlying facts. The statute doesn't say that. It says that it only protects the confidential communication. The Attorney General has agreed with that. The Supreme Court of the United States in the Upjohn case recognized that the privileged communication does not extend to the underlying facts. So the attorney who was representing the employee who felt that she had been or he had been sexually harassed would be able to discover the fact that the HR person conducted an investigation, would be able to discover the results of that investigation, but the one thing that they could not discover would be the conversation between that HR manager and the attorney with regard to what the HR manager told the attorney and what the attorney in turn told the HR manager.
Well, what if the HR supervisor, suppose the one of the questions is whether management had notice of this conduct, because I'm sure that that is an element of a sexual harassment
Certainly.
Case, all right?
Yes.
And the only, how else could you prove it that management had knowledge if the supervisor's report of the incident is going to be foreclosed from discovery?
Well, the only report that's foreclosed, and I don't view it as a report, is a communication with the attorney about the incident. But the fact that the employee complained to the supervisor or someone else told the supervisor about this incident and the fact that it could be sexual harassment, that is discoverable. That's the underlying fact. That this bill and the attorney-client privilege doesn't change that fact.
Well,
we're really only talking about to whom does the privilege extend and who is the client? And is it merely the officers and directors of the corporation, or does it go further than that and extend to managers who need and seek legal advice?
If an assembly line worker reports to management that there is some intentional use of defective equipment in the manufacture of this product, and the attorney gets involved in an investigation and talks to this employee who made this report.
Yes.
Then I take it that the employee's conversation with the attorney would be privileged under this bill.
Yes. But the fact that the employee saw something and felt that there was something amiss is not protected.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, I'm thinking of the situation where knowledge of the employer is a critical element in proving the claim, and trying to understand how what would happen if you needed to rely upon some agent or employee way down the line having communicated something to I suppose the example might be that there is a there's something that's gone wrong in the manufacturing process, we'll say. So the attorney and the president and two or three other people form this committee, and they make this investigation, and the attorney is out there and he's interviewing these workers on the assembly line now.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks to one of these workers, who then gives him, the corporate counsel, and the rest of the committee this information about what really happened. And the decision is made not to alter the process, just go ahead and continue to use the defective material or what have you. Now, does that, the conversation that arises out of that investigation, I assume would be privileged because it was given to the attorney that's making this investigation?
Well, I think so, but that assumes that the attorney is the first person that is told about this particular situation, and I don't think in normal practice and the way things happen that would be the case. The most likely occurrence and scenario would be that the production line worker would tell his or her superior about this problem and complain and say, hey, this needs to be fixed. Do something about it. And that communication would not be protected by this bill. And that could be discovered, and the fact could be established that employee complained and told his or her supervisor about the problem.
But the report, I'm sure that you're right, it probably isn't the general rule, but whenever an employee, no matter how low in ranking, makes a communication to the person who's acting as one of 37 in-house counsel about a factual situation, would that that communication would be precluded from a discovery whenever that situation might arise, even if it's not very often? But that would be the mere fact that an employee makes a communication to a person acting as corporate counsel or one of the corporate counsel, that act then takes that communication out of the realm of discovery.
I'm not sure I'd concede that it's quite that broad, because the communication has to be in connection with the attorneys providing legal advice and services to the company. It just can't be any sort of communication. And it has to involve the attorney's activities and fact gathering and trying to advise the company on a particular legal matter.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, counsel?
Perhaps we could clarify things a little by asking what is meant by the term manager and attorney. I take it from your comments, Mr. Lewis, that an attorney acting as an attorney is not a manager in the ordinary course of events.
That would be correct. In our company, we do have one manager that manages the department, but he's not referred to as a manager. He happens to be a vice president of the company.
But he manages the legal affairs and not, say, a production line.
Absolutely.
So he would not have decision-making authority over what happens on the production line.
That's correct.
And I assume that it's your experience that corporate counsel are not able to go out into a company and make decisions about how the company is going to be run outside of legal affairs.
No. One, we don't have the time, and number two, people don't want us doing that. That's their job. We're merely to provide advice, and we're a service to the company, but we're not the operating people that are making operational decisions on what the company does as far as its basic operations.
Okay, now if we get at this from the other side, assume that you have somebody with a legal background whose job is, say, a vice president of production, and whose work involves seeing that certain products get out rather than giving legal advice. Would that person, who is acting as a production manager, would that person's communications be protected under this bill simply because they have a law degree?
No, because the bill, and again, the bill doesn't even change a lot of the provisions that are presently in the law, and the law requires that the communication has to be made for the purpose of facilitating the rendition of professional legal services. And that person that you are describing is not going to be providing professional legal services on behalf of the company. That's the job of my department. The fact that he happens to have a legal background is of interest, but that's not his or her job to be providing legal services. And therefore, as far as I'm concerned, that communication would not be protected.
Thank you.
Let me just put one suggestion before you here. On line 20 of page 1, you're saying that that this communication really has to be for the purpose of obtaining legal advice. Is that it?
In connection with that,
yeah.
Yes.
All right. I might have a little difficulty with the phrase, by means of which information a client may obtain. I'll just throw this out now, and you don't even have to comment on it if you don't want to, but instead of the words, by means of which information the client may obtain, substitute the words, for the purpose of obtaining. So if the information is provided for the purpose of obtaining legal advice or legal services, I'd have a little better understanding of what this accomplishes than the way it's presently worded. So I'll leave that with you, and you can think about it.
I would like to just refer you, Senator Frye, to subsection 2 of the present law that talks about the privilege and says that the communication has to be made for the purpose of facilitating the rendition of professional legal services to the client. That's part of the existing law, and that's still a condition to any privilege applying. That's on page 1. Down towards the bottom of the first page, subsection 2, where it describes what
what the privilege is about.
Yes. I'm not too certain, though, that necessarily be read as in connection with the definition of representative of the client. That's what we're talking about there in the subsection capital A. We're trying to define what a representative of the client is.
Yes, but representative client has no meaning except in 2, when it describes how representative of client comes into importance. And it's got to be in this situation where the communication is made for the purpose of facilitating the rendition of professional legal services to the client, and then goes on and talks about in what kinds of settings that can happen. But that's sort of a touchstone to the application of the privilege.
Okay. Go ahead.
We believe that as a matter of fundamental fairness, the privilege should fully apply to corporate employees and not just individuals. And that's basically the extent of it, because I think we've touched on some issues that I was going to talk about, this issue of the privilege not extending to underlying facts, but merely protecting the communication itself.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Peter Jarvis. I'm a partner with the Portland firm of Stolries, Bowley, Fraser, and Wise, and I'm here on my own behalf and also on behalf of the Business and Corporate Law section, which supports this bill. I'd like to start with how we come to be here and how we come to have this problem about attorney-client privilege in corporations. As a matter of our basic legal system, we rely heavily upon not simply advice from lawyers to individuals who are in trouble, but also advice every day, day in, day out, to keep people out of trouble. In the case of an individual, there's no question who the client is. The client is whoever comes in and sees the individual, and that's that. Corporations, of course, can't act apart from individuals, so the question arises, where do you draw the line within the corporation? And whether the present line that's drawn at the control group level is a proper line or whether the line should be elsewhere. To go back to the senator's hypothetical, suppose I have a mom-and-pop grocery store as a client, and they come in and they ask me for advice about some employee who's complained about something or other, and I give them advice and they fail to follow it. I don't think there'd be any disagreement, but that their failure to follow my advice is privileged, and that no one's going to be able to get at that specific conversation unless they put it in issue in the context of an individual.
No, I don't know that I'd agree with that.
If,
go ahead.
At a minimum, if you do, well, there are various ways that it comes up, and as a practical matter, what's more common than not is you have the employer wanting to argue reliance on advice of counsel, and therefore the employer brings it up, and the employer waives privilege at that time. It doesn't very often happen in my 11-plus years doing it that it happens the other way. But there are all sorts of times that people don't follow the advice of counsel, and in the case of individuals, we regard that as privileged. People may take a different position on their taxes, for example, than their attorneys represent. It's completely privileged, and so it should be. The underlying facts, what the mom-and-pop grocery store owner saw, what his employee or her employee saw and when that came and caused him to talk to me in the first instance, that's not privileged. That's never been privileged. And that wouldn't be privileged by this bill. But the basic idea that you can talk to your attorney and get advice from your attorney is a fundamental part of the whole system. And the only question here is how should that be applied to corporations, and in effect whether corporations are deserving of less privilege, less protection than we grant individuals. And I don't think they are. And this is not just a problem for Tektronix. This is a problem for every corporation. A small corporation or a partnership can have employees. Those employees need not be a part of the control group. In fact, commonly will not be a part of the control group. And if they're not a part of the control group, the small corporation or the partnership has the same exact problem that we're talking about here. All that this bill would do is bring the Oregon bill, the Oregon law, in line with the federal law. Now, I haven't noticed any great tendency of people to shy away from federal litigation or any great complaint from the plaintiff's bar that they can't get the discovery that they want in federal litigation because of the federal attorney-client privilege. rule. That's not the way it goes. In fact, there are certain federal statutes, such as employment discrimination, such as sex discrimination, which are preferred remedies. And they're preferred remedies, notwithstanding the fact that there may be some bits of information or pieces of information that people can't get because of privilege, which is to say the actual privileged communications themselves. But the underlying facts, the underlying circumstances, are all capable of discovery. What this bill seeks to make it tougher to do, in line with existing federal law, is to make it tougher for someone to try their case on wits borrowed from their adversary, as the phrase is put. You got to go out and you got to explore the facts on your own if you want to be a plaintiff. You can't just roll up and say, all right, defendant, tell me what you told your lawyer and what your lawyer told you, and then I'll just go home. You have to go out and do your own discovery and learn your own facts, and that's the way it works. I understand that one of the arguments made against this bill is that it would put a cloak of silence over the activities of defendants. If that's true, I've been wasting a lot of my clients' time and money over the last 11 years. We respond to discovery. We respond to discovery extensively. We respond to discovery.
Brenneman.
Aye.
Brockman.
Aye.
Cohen.
No.
Hamby.
Aye.
Hill.
No.
Wires.
No.
Fry.
No. That fails.
Move the bill.
All right. Senator Hamby moves Senate Bill 133 as amended to the floor do pass. Senator Brockman.
No, something very interesting occurs to me. Weren't we supposed to put in some dollar values in these fines that they're imposing on these people? I thought that was the real reason it came here in the first place. Weren't there some civil penalties here, and the reason they sent it to us was to put the right limits on them?
Mr. Chairman.
No, Counsel.
If you look on page 4 at line 7 and line 9 and line 17, the dollar values are there, and what the committee wanted, the Water Policy Committee wanted this committee to do was simply review the process used and to make sure that this language was consistent with other kinds of statutes that have passed.
That's what that last amendment does, isn't it? Isn't that
yes.
The purpose of that amendment from Legislative Council?
In part, yes. Yeah. But the Water Policy Committee had put the dollar values for the civil penalties in the bill. And then their question to us was, is the process correct?
You want to make any changes, suggest any changes in that? Anybody?
Question, Mr.
Yes, Chair. Senator Hamby.
And the question of retroactive penalties has also then been addressed and is consistent.
Yes, and that is consistent with several other statutes.
Let's see. Now, what? So the dash 10 amendment is to conform the procedure then to other statutes?
The dash 10 amendment deals with the procedure for recording civil penalties with the county clerk in the lien records and providing that it becomes a judgment on the property.
Yeah.
And so that the procedure is identical for water. It makes the procedure identical for water policy that now exists for a variety of other administrative agencies. The original language of the bill would have set up a second procedure, and they figured that one procedure for doing that for all agencies was sufficient.
Well, I don't have any. Senator Cohen, do you have any?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, I just want to make sure everybody's happy with this. All right.
That's why it's here. I just thought it was appropriate that we should talk about it for a minute or so.
Okay. The record will reflect that we talked about it for a minute or so. Okay, call the roll on Senator Hamby's motion.
Brenneman.
No.
Brockman.
Aye.
Cohen.
Aye.
Hamby.
Aye.
Hill.
Aye.
Wires. Fry.
Aye. That passes. Okay, now let's see. All right, let's go to Senate Bill 441.
Mr. Chair.
Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could refer you to three documents in your files. There's two LC amendments, dash 4 and dash 5. And being passed around to you is a hand-engrossed version of the bill that incorporates both sets of amendments. You'll recall that the original bill as printed provided that minors gave the court the authority to require minors to repay court costs, attorney's fees, and also addressed the issue of a minor committed to a training school to pay restitution. Since then, there have been a number of proposed changes, and let me briefly tell you what the two sets of amendments do. The dash 4 amendments have the effect of removing the attorney fees and cost provision so that the court could require restitution and the victim's assessment fee to be paid, but not attorney's fees and costs. This was both the most of the witnesses who testified on this bill were in favor of this amendment. So Senator Riles, in conjunction with the Juvenile Rights Project and others, crafted that amendment. Second thing that Dash 4 does is address the issue of when a minor is committed to a training school and ordered to pay restitution, that the court consider the availability to the child of paid employment. There are only a limited number of paying jobs available to juveniles committed to the training schools, and the effect of this amendment would be to require the court to take that into consideration before ordering restitution. So those are the two major changes that the Dash 4 amendments do. The Dash 5 amendments first align the definitions of restitution and community service to those definitions provided in the ORS as applied to adult offenders. Secondly, it provides a new provision, and those are in lines 10 to 20 of the Dash 5 amendments, of providing the court with the option, as a condition of probation, of requiring the juvenile to provide direct service to the victim. This would be as a condition of probation and only upon agreement of the child's parent or guardian, and the victim. If the court does authorize this direct service to the victim, then that would be credited toward any restitution that the court would order.
I don't have dash five. I don't either.
Okay.
Anybody have dash 5?
Let me then refer you in the hand engrossed to page 3 after line 35.
That's the
New sub 7. So that's the new provision. Again, it requires all the parties' consent. It requires that the direct service be credited to any restitution order. There's some language that's unnecessary and rather confusing. If you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I believe it's the 7th line down in sub 7, the words "as provided by agreement" are just surplusage and unnecessary, and we should probably delete those words. The other amendment that's provided in Dash 5, reflected in the hand engrossed, is on page 4 of the hand engrossed version, labeled Section 2. And this is a message. It's a policy message to the Children's Services Division and the Juvenile Departments to make available to offenders those services that might be necessary to enable them to pay restitution and the penalty assessments. We'll make a copy available to you of the Dash 4 and the Dash 5 amendments. I made sure that they were delineated separately because the Dash 4 amendments were specifically discussed about and seemed to draw the consensus of people at the committee at the last meeting. The Dash 5 amendments are somewhat different. So that's where we are in 441. Senator Riles is here. Ann Harris, a major proponent of the bill, is here also to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Yes, Senator Cohen.
Can I ask why we have the upon the review of child parent or guardian and the victim report may order? Is that really, could I hear some discussion of why we want all of those agreements in there? I'm not debating it. I just need to. I can understand the victim making.
Senator Ross, do you have any additional of the dash 5
amendments? I've got I have a copy of dash 5. Do you want to use it? For the record, State Senator Nancy Riles, District 3. Now, excuse me, Senator Cohen, what were you asking me?
Yeah, I'm looking at sub 7 on page. Yeah. On the third page there. I just need some, for the record, rationale of why you need to have the agreement of the child, the for the court to order.
Okay. For the record, my name is Ann Harris, and I reside in Multnomah County. This language was included upon your example given in the last hearing, a court ordering a youth to mow a lawn or whatever, which is, in short terms, referred to as direct service to a victim. The language needed to be there because that's not construed by the statute as restitution. It is, in essence, non-paid service restitution. So the language, it was recommended that the language be incorporated so that it was clarified what we were talking about, and it had to be upon the agreement of the child, a parent or guardian, and also the victim. In other words, the court cannot arbitrarily order such.
I don't think the court could arbitrarily order anything on.
Well, but I mean, there has to be some sort of dialogue so that if the youth is ordered to mow a lawn or something, the victim isn't in agreement to it. I want to say mediation, some discussion prior to it actually going to the judge actually ordering it. It's a clarification, clear language.
Well, I just need to understand, and maybe anybody else wants. I just want to make sure we understand.
For the record, Keith Meisenheimer, Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County. Don't think I was there when there was discussion of that particular language. I'm not sure what the rationale is for having the parent's guardian, or the parent or guardian, have a veto power over that. But it seems to me that maybe there is some sense in saying that the child should agree in advance, or the personal service, the whole purpose of that may not work out well. If you got an unwilling child or a child that feels forced into that situation.
Okay, I just need to know for the record what.
Any other questions on this?
I clearly understand what.
Any other questions on this point? Any other questions on any of the other amendments proposed here? Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, counsel.
There appears to be one small wording amendment that's incorporated into the hand engrossed version that didn't make it to dash 4 or dash 5. If I could direct you to page 1, line 28, the words or not, they were just added to clarify the language and don't make any material change. Other than that, I believe that hand engrossed 441 reflects both the dash 4 and the dash 5 amendments.
Or not. Oh, or not, excuse me, can I just ask, the or not is in the, is not in, or not is not in the dash 4 amendments?
I didn't see it in dash 4 or dash 5, okay. But it is in the hand engrossed.
I think it got left out of the.
Yeah, yes.
Mr. Chairman,
I. Yes, Senator Cohen.
Well, I guess I do.
Yeah, but it's in.
Okay, I would move that we amend the bill, the hand engrossed bill that we have in front of the Senate Bill 441, mm-hmm. by deleting on page 3, the seventh line, subsection 7, after the word court, we as provided by agreement.
Don't you want to delete the whole sentence, the whole rest of it? Wasn't that your suggestion, Counsel?
No, just the words as provided by agreement, and probably the comma as well after court. So the full sentence would then read, personal service performed pursuant to the order shall constitute full or partial satisfaction of any restitution ordered by the court prior to the making of the order.
Right. Any objection? Okay, it's ordered. Don't we have to? Do we
have more?
Do we have four and five in this hand and gross?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Just to say the or not is mark in my sub four is
okay.
Or
well,
not
yes.
On line
six. Whatever it is in the hand and gross, and I'm inclined that for the record they include dash four and dash five.
Let's put today's date on the hand and gross bill here, 5-5.
Yes, as are the dated legislative council amendments, dash four and 5-5.
Well, okay, now, four and five are in this thing right here, right?
They are.
Okay, so Senator Cohen moves hand and gross and otherwise amended, but it's shown in hand and gross Senate Bill 441, dated 5-5-87. To the floor, do pass, right? Okay, call the roll on that, please.
Brenneman? Brockman?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Byers?
Aye. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Well, let's see what I got in terms of out-of-town folks here. What's that? See, we have... there we are. Oh. Okay, because I think it's a clean file. Okay, I think I'm looking at all the sign-up sheets here now, and I think there's only one witness from out of town. That's Mr. Stiles from Portland on House Bill 3071. Is there any other person from out of town here on any other bill?
Kathy Bogan.
Kathy, I thought you lived in Salem. You live in Portland, too? You're a hired gun, though, aren't you?
Not exactly.
Not exactly.
Do that.
All right, 2309. Come on, we'll take that one next. I don't have a sign-up sheet on that. I don't have a sign-up sheet, but maybe... Is there anyone else to testify on that? Oh, we got three witnesses for the place. Okay. All right. Uh, 2309. Go ahead, please.
Committee members, I'm Connie Osborne, representing Westside Parents in Crisis in Portland, a parents support group for acting out adolescents, and I'm also here as an individual. You should have testimony that the aide is handing out right at the moment. It is reduced testimony, 2 pages on one sheet for your convenience.
Yes,
it might be a little bit harder on your eyes, but at least it consolidates it to one sheet. HB 2309 was presented in tandem with HB 2307 to the House Side and House Judiciary Committee for the Best Interests of Children Services Division. It doesn't really matter who sponsored the bills or what committee recommended that they be submitted. For your information, HB 2307 after heated testimony in the House side, along with 2309, has been defeated. It regarded Children's Services Division terminating parental rights in the matter of emotional deficiency, so-called emotional deficiency of parents. This bill regards the state taking automatic custody in the matter of the death of a parent or parents. It has been amended nicely, so I am in concurrence with the amendments to provide protection to the child. Heretofore, it stated that the state would have first right of option to the child, and now as the amendment, if you notice on the amendment sheet, as was passed, that the parents, if no willing, qualified, or suitable relative or other person is available and has petitioned the court for guardian appointment. Per my testimony that I've reduplicated from the House Judiciary side, the basic contention, and I am not for this bill as it stands, and that basic reason is that it's a duplication of language as provided in ORS 126-2-3, which has long been standing the judicial practice and protection in the matter of deceased parents and minor children. And very honestly, ladies and gentlemen, this should have been checked out even by the House side before it was sent over here. Even though the bill does refer to 126060, the provision for the court recognizing the deceased parent's will is in 126233, and it does list systematically the parties involved and their order of consideration. That is the number one reason why I am asking this committee to kill this bill at this point in time, because it is a it would represent duplicated language in our statutory code for a statute that is more than adequate, and this is not just my expertise, but that of attorneys working in the area of minors and parent custody. HB 2309 is not even necessary, according to downline administrators of Children's Services Division. On a radio show March 4th in Portland on KEX Radio, June Anderson of the Portland office, which comprises the largest branch office in CSD in the state, testified that the state routinely takes children in the matter of deceased parents where there are no other relatives involved. They were not even aware that this bill existed and purport that there is no need for its existence. I am confident that the court would not allow a child to go homeless or without proper custodial protection should there be no will or instate or relative to assume custody of the child upon the death of the parent. The other thing is that we need to ask, as I've indicated on page 2 of my testimony to the House, is what percentage of the state population does this statute actually represent a need for in order to have it on the books again? And are CSD's demands for this law greater than the need really exists? You'll note that there are no appropriations attached to this. They don't even cite a percentage that they have handled to date or that they project to handle. Lastly, that the EU legislatures, I feel, need to start scrutinizing and be more sensitive and aware of the state's intervention and its role in governing the lives of young people. The state substitute care is really very inadequate in regards to the matter of children that they have taken custody where the parents have deceased, and they really don't even do a very good job with children where the parents are alive in taking care of our young people in this state. And again, I refer to the kids who I feel are the bottom line. I do know graduates of the CSD system, and it is less than desirable, and frankly, it should be the very last option. Again, this bill is as acceptable as it has now been revised, but its necessity is, has been eliminated by the virtue of the amendments. And you do need to check out the provisions in 126.233 before you do consider possibly in a work session, so passing it today, that it is a duplication of language. Does anybody have any questions of me?
All right. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, Fred Stock.
My name is Fred Stock. I'm the manager of Adoption Services for Children's Services Division, and I, Larry Young is here with the Attorney General's Office, who's counsel. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay for Mr. Young to give his presentation, that does give some citations of the statute language as it's being addressed here.
That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Lawrence Young, Chief Counsel of the Family Law Section in the Department of Justice. I do have written testimony, which I have submitted to the committee. I hadn't signed up because I came in late. I assume the sign-up sheet was already in your hands. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the history of this bill. It started out in the interim with Mr. Swank calling up the Department of Justice Family Law Section and asking if there were any problems with any of the statutes that might be subject to being addressed by the Interim Judiciary Committee. At that point, we replied, yes, there was a technical problem involving adoption of children when both parents of the child had died. And that's how this bill got its start. It was massaged by the Interim Judiciary Committee, eventually pre-session filed at the request of that committee, and after going through the House, it has come to you today. I have listened to Ms. Osborne, and I am somewhat mystified as to what she is talking about in comparison to what I understand what the bill does. The bill is not something to give CSD greater or lesser power or control how CSD handles a child in custody per se. It involves instead a very technical problem in the law. What do you do if a child is suddenly orphaned? Both parents have died and there's nobody to take the child, and you want to adopt that child out. How legally do you go about getting an adoption? What has been standard CSD practice is for CSD to get itself appointed as the legal guardian and then to consent to adoption. And there are two basic problems with that process. Even though it's been followed, it's routinely followed every day in this state. First of all, the guardianship statutes in Chapter 126 speak of guardians as being people. CSD is not a person per se. This bill addresses that concern and does authorize CSD to be a guardian for purposes of adoption. That's what Section 1 does. CSD may be made a guardian of the minor upon appointment of the court if the minor has no living parents, and there are various other conditions inserted by the House. In that case, the division shall be considered a person under the relevant guardianship statutes. The second thing it does is it grants specific statutory authority to the Children's Services Division to consent to an adoption. Now, the House Judiciary Committee was concerned that nobody else wanted the child first, and so they inserted language in Section 1 making sure that there were no other willing, qualified, or suitable relatives, and no person who is available has petitioned the court for appointment as a guardian. And secondly, they were concerned about notice, so they stuck in a new Section 2 to ensure that notice would be given to a wide range of people, so that everybody who might have an interest in the child would have an opportunity to come forward and petition to be the guardian of the child. That's basically what the bill does. It allows CSD to be appointed a guardian for purposes of consenting to adoption, and it allows CSD to consent to such an adoption.
Now, on line 15 of the House amendments, the phrase, a will file for probate action. Now, what if there is some preference expressed in the will, but the will is not filed for probate? Of course, it wouldn't come to the attention, I guess, of CSD, but...
in any instance where CSD would be aware, that certainly would be respected. You're right, Senator, that unless we were aware of it, we would not have any cause or reason to take any action contrary other than by the proceedings that we're attempting to facilitate the adoption of the child. As Mr. Young has pointed out, and I think you have in my written testimony there too, that CSD was actually not aware that we were in a position that we could not be appointed guardian, and in fact, in those instances where there have been no living parents on the adoption of the CSD children that we're planning on, we have been appointed that guardian. What this does is literally legitimizes some action that might be challengeable if there was ever an appeal made on the proceedings. There is absolutely no impact whatsoever of workload issues. There's not any change in procedures as to the types of children, the types of circumstances that we have been proceeding for a number of years in adoption planning where children do not have living parents. My best estimate is that this involves probably no less than 10 cases a year. Last fiscal year, we placed 276 children adoptively, and we'll have approximately that same number this fiscal year.
Well, I wonder why, if the House is so concerned about notice to relatives, why didn't it just say that if CSD proposes to be the guardian, that notice shall be given to all known relatives, siblings, grandparents? Just a minute. I'll find out now. Do you know the answer to that? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I do not. I was not present during the House hearings on this bill. Right. They were done by Deborah Wilson.
I might say that I believe it was Representative Llewellyn provided some testimony of concern here, and in that due course, that is how this language was put together that you have before you, and the Representative Llewellyn felt that that satisfied the concerns that she had, that it didn't provide any additional power for the Children's Services Division, and that clearly is not the intent of this bill that has been presented from the onset.
That. It just seems to me that that could be a little more, if the intention is to give notice to close relatives who might want to intervene or resist that, then I think it could be